Let's be honest. Buying cannabis shouldn't be complicated, sketchy, or low quality. That's why I want to tell you about Mood.com. That's Mood.com. Mood ships federally legal cannabis straight to your door. No medical card, no hassle. And here's the kicker. The quality is better than anything you'll find at your local dispensary. Yeah, I said it. Whether you're into edibles, concentrates, flower, or just looking to explore, you'll find it all at Mood. And it's not just the variety that makes them stand out. Every product is sourced from small, American-owned family farms that care deeply about what they grow. It's cannabis you can trust, delivered discreetly, and ready to elevate your mood. And because you're a listener, you get 20% off your first order. Just head to Mood.com. That's Mood.com to get started.
Let's be honest. Buying cannabis shouldn't be complicated, sketchy, or low quality. That's why I want to tell you about Mood.com. That's Mood.com. Mood ships federally legal cannabis straight to your door. No medical card, no hassle. And here's the kicker. The quality is better than anything you'll find at your local dispensary. Yeah, I said it. Whether you're into edibles, concentrates, flower, or just looking to explore, you'll find it all at Mood. And it's not just the variety that makes them stand out. Every product is sourced from small, American-owned family farms that care deeply about what they grow. It's cannabis you can trust, delivered discreetly, and ready to elevate your mood. And because you're a listener, you get 20% off your first order. Just head to Mood.com. That's Mood.com to get started.
The Case for Free Trade. Kent Lassman. Trade policy is about more than goods and services. It is a statement of American identity. Our trade policy choices reveal America's values and where we put our trust. Do we place our trust in Washington elites to revive a declining country, or do we trust in America's tradition of entrepreneurs and everyday people blazing new trails? Do we follow China by copying its strong-arm trade policies, or do we lead China and the rest of the world by forging our own path? Our trade policy decisions will tell you what we Americans really think of ourselves. A conservative vision for trade. The policy recommendations in this chapter reflect a belief in the strength of America's founding institutions, its economy, and its people. They are based on data showing decades of American progress with all that this implies. They also reflect a realistic understanding of the fact that trade policy has limited capabilities and is vulnerable to mission creep and regulatory capture. Policymakers should be modest about what they can accomplish through trade policy and need to exercise constant vigilance against abuses. For example, trade can lower consumer prices for ordinary Americans and open new markets for American businesses and their goods. Trade can help American workers and businesses to specialize in what they do best, which is how they outcompete the rest of the world in technology, manufacturing, agriculture, and other areas. In foreign policy, trade can help to preserve and strengthen alliances. At the same time, sound trade policy requires humility. It is not a panacea for every policy problem. Trade policy cannot favor one sector over another without causing trade-offs that outweigh the benefits. Neither free trade nor protectionism will create jobs. Trade affects the types of jobs people have, but it has no long-run effect on the number of jobs. Labor force size is tied to population size more than anything else. The American people are smart and sophisticated enough to hear these truths. It is not just conservatives who overestimate the power of trade policy. Recent progressive attempts to use trade policy to advance whole-of-government initiatives on climate, equity, and other issues will fail for the same reason that a hammer cannot turn a screw. It is the wrong tool for the job. Conservatives should be similarly skeptical of recent attempts on the right to use progressive trade policy to punish political opponents, remake manufacturing, or accomplish other objectives for which it is not suited. The next administration needs to end the mission creep that has all but taken over trade policy in recent years. Trade policy works best when it sticks to trade and treats separate issues separately. Trade agreements, since the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, have been increasingly burdened by trade-unrelated provisions involving labor, environmental, intellectual property, and other regulations. Where these were a side agreement to NAFTA in the 1990s, they were integrated into the main text of the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, USMCA, in 2019. The Indo-Pacific Economic Framework for Prosperity, IPEF, that the Biden administration is currently pursuing consists entirely of trade-unrelated provisions. Negotiations are steering clear of trade altogether. Trade-unrelated provisions are routinely hijacked by progressives and rent seekers and dilute otherwise worthwhile trade agreements. They also create additional points of contention that make agreements unnecessarily difficult to pass. A conservative trade policy should limit trade-unrelated provisions in trade agreements. This does not mean that conservatives should ignore international negotiations on labor, environment, intellectual property, and other non-trade issues. It means they are more likely to succeed by treating each of them separately rather than letting them die in committee, with each providing an additional sticking point for delaying the others. A conservative trade policy must also take seriously the reality that in a democracy, the other side holds power about half of the time, but progressives run most agencies almost all of the time. A cardinal rule in public policy is not to give yourself powers you wouldn't want your opponents to have. That means building institution-level safeguards against mission creep to limit abuses. Foreign policy considerations are not as separate from trade as are labor or environmental standards. China deserves special consideration, as does the World Trade Organization, the WTO, along with its possible successors or alternatives. While trade is not the star of American foreign policy, it does play a supporting role. It should be used to strengthen alliances to help counter China, Russia, and other threats while making economic and cultural inroads inside them. The next American president should use this aspect of trade to the nation's advantage, drawing from America's roots. In 1776, nearly 90% of Americans were farmers. For 10 people to eat, 9 had to farm. That meant fewer people could be factory workers, doctors, or teachers, or even live in cities because they were needed on the farm. Accordingly, life expectancy was around 40 years, and literacy was 13%. Today, fewer than 1% of Americans work on farms, yet America is a net exporter of food. People have infinite wants. So as rising productivity pushed some people off of farms, there were countless other jobs they could do. In true American fashion, many of these jobs were in brand new industries. This was possible because the same can-do cultural values that inspired the American founding were accurately reflected in its new government. The U.S. Constitution created what was then the world's largest free trade area, and it did so on purpose. The combination of the American self-improvement ethos and the large free internal market guaranteed by the Constitution yielded intensive growth on a scale never before seen. Many displaced farm laborers got jobs making the very farm equipment that made intensive agricultural growth possible, from railroad networks to cotton gins. Each fed the other. Agriculture and industry are not separate. They are as interconnected as everything else in the economy. None of this could have happened had the government enacted policies to preserve full agricultural employment. Understanding value. Just as communication is impossible without agreed-upon definitions of words, coherent policymaking is impossible without coherent categories. Policies are not likely to succeed when they try to separate an interconnected economy into arbitrary categories. The factory worker who builds a tractor does as much to boost farm production as the farmers themselves. Yet, economic planners put them in different categories. This problem is baked into industrial policy, as progressive planners have learned again and again. A conservative approach to economic policy should treat value as value, whether it is created on a farm, in a factory, or
bag huge savings on your painting projects at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim, and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect choice for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. DuraFighter interior paint starts at $27.75 a gallon. Get an additional 15% savings on all Dutch Boy paints when you put it in the bag. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
In an office. A dollar of value created in manufacturing is neither more nor less valuable than a dollar of value created in agriculture or services. Pursuing access to growing markets. American history holds lessons for today's conservative trade policy. Some modern analysts see a correlation between high tariffs and high growth and confuse it for causation, but 19th century America teaches a different lesson. While the Constitution banned internal tariffs in the U.S., international tariffs reached their highest levels in U.S. history during the 19th century, beginning with the 1828 Tariff of Abominations. At their peak in 1830, the average tariff on dutiable goods was 62%. Fortunately, however, the tariff's distorting effects were outweighed by market growth elsewhere. The 19th century saw Western expansion and a growing population, including millions of immigrants working for the American dream. America's growing internal free trade zone allowed for still more specialization and more trade across state borders. America's geographic expansion ended long ago, but population growth, the U.S.-led rules-based international trading system, and the steady 75-year decline in tariffs after World War II have made possible decades of continued prosperity. Intensive growth requires specialization, and the larger the market, the more specialization is possible. Fighting pessimistic bias. Farmers' share of the population continued to decline through this entire period, yet employment remained high and the economy continued to grow. Factories were not the only beneficiaries of agriculture's productivity boom and the labor it freed. Services also grew. In fact, service sector employment surpassed manufacturing employment around 1890. Far earlier than most people realize. Pessimistic bias is one of the most important cultural problems that conservative policymakers need to address. In trade, as in most other areas, few people ever zoom out to see the big picture, which is one reason why so many people mistakenly believe that U.S. manufacturing and the U.S. economy are in decline. The data do not show American economic carnage. They show more than two centuries of intensive growth, made possible by a growing internal market throughout the 19th century and a growing international market in the post-World War II era. The transition from farm to factory did not shrink the labor force, factory output, or farm output. Both transitions affected the types of jobs, not the number of jobs. Americans today can more easily afford everything from air conditioning to flat-screen televisions and smartphones, and trade is one reason why. Bigger markets mean more specialization, more innovative ideas, more customers, and more people from whom to buy. America's official unemployment rate went as low as 3.5% during 2022, while real per capita gross domestic product, GDP, rose to an all-time record. Clearly, people who wanted to work were able to find work that paid well, even as manufacturing jobs grew more slowly than service jobs. Implementing the conservative vision. Vision will be crucial for the next conservative administration, but nuts and bolts policies are also important. Making the conservative vision for trade a reality will require several actions, some of which may prove to be more difficult to achieve than others. Specifically, implement tariff relief to help counteract inflation by reducing prices for affected goods, as well as to strengthen supply chains and boost manufacturing. End. Section 232, 201, and 301 tariffs. Work with Congress to pass legislation repealing those provisions so future presidents cannot abuse them. Resist calls for more spending on trade adjustment assistance, which is often hijacked for progressive ends. Technology and changing tastes displace 6 times as many workers as does trade, yet those workers get no such special treatment. Displaced workers should receive the same benefits regardless of the reason. Remove never-needed supply chain restrictions, which give families fewer places to which they can turn. The recent shortage of baby formula, for example, was caused largely by heavily protectionist regulations. Strength and resilience come from openness. Enact mutual recognition policies with allies. If a product is safe enough for European or Japanese consumers, then it is safe enough for Americans as well, and vice versa. This can reduce regulatory costs and open new markets. Close the Export-Import Bank, which serves mainly to subsidize foreign buyers' purchases of goods from a handful of well-connected American manufacturers. Repeal the Jones Act, a century-old Buy American maritime law that has decimated the U.S. shipbuilding industry. Work with Congress to restore the President's Trade Promotion Authority, which would expedite the negotiation of trade agreements with the United Kingdom, Switzerland, Taiwan, the European Union, and other allies, and keep trade-unrelated provisions out of trade agreements. Restore the World Trade Organization's dispute resolution process to full strength. Create a successor to the WTO, assuming that it has been fatally wounded, that is open only to liberal democracies. This would prevent authoritarian countries like China from abusing the organization for their own ends. Adopt a multi-pronged China strategy to convince the Chinese government to reform its illiberal human rights and trade policies. Rejoin the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, whose 11 members are developing institutional trade norms in an important geopolitical region without U.S. input or involvement. Reorient the proposed Indo-Pacific Economic Framework for Prosperity to focus only on trade issues, which it currently ignores in favor of progressive wish list policies. Strengthen diplomatic pressure in concert with allies against Beijing's abuses. Encourage cultural and intellectual engagement with the Chinese people, remembering that blue jeans and rock and roll helped to win the Cold War. Tariff relief. When people try something repeatedly and it still doesn't work, they should stop doing it, especially when the consequences turn out to be just what conservative economists have long predicted they would be. With tariffs, the proper reform is not only to get rid of the individual tariffs that have backfired, but also to build institutional safeguards against future abuse. We are 5 years into the biggest experiment with tariffs since the Great Depression, and the results are in. The new tariffs raise consumer prices for ordinary Americans by about $200 per household every year and benefit only a small number of special interests. Steel and aluminum tariffs, enacted on national security grounds, angered allies. Beijing made not a single substantive reform in response to 4 rounds of tariffs plus an attempted Phase One agreement. The Biden administration has left the tariffs in place and is expanding them to pursue progressive policy goals. The first order of business for a new administration that is focused on American workers and consumers is to repeal all tariffs enacted under Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962 and Sections 201 and 301 of the Trade Act of 1974. The president can do this unilaterally, and Congress can do it through legislation. The second order of business requires Congress to pass legislation repealing Sections 232, 201, and 301. The U.S. Constitution places all taxing authority with Congress and none with the president. Congress used those provisions of law to delegate some of its taxing authority to the president because it was having trouble passing clean tariff legislation in the 1960s and 1970s. Unless and until this constitutional question about delegation is addressed, important reforms are available to the next Congress and the next president. Congress faced a problem of collective action in the 1960s and 1970s. As a whole, members generally wanted to lower tariffs, but few individual members were willing to remove tariffs that benefited special interests in their districts. Trade bills were invariably watered down through amendments and log rolling. The thinking was that the president, whose constituency is the entire nation, would be less prone to special interest pleading than members of Congress would be. So Congress delegated some of its tariff-making authority to the president in 1962 and 1974 trade legislation. Delegating tariff-making might have worked in the short run, but in the long run, it was both constitutionally dubious and ripe for abuse. That came to pass in 2018. The Section 232 steel and aluminum tariffs, invoked in 2018 against Canada, Europe, and other allies on national security grounds, raised car prices by an average of $250 per vehicle and gave America the world's highest steel prices. They also harmed the construction, canned food and beverage, and other metal-using industries. While this may have benefited the steel industry itself, each steel job saved cost an average of $650,000 per year that had been taken from elsewhere in the economy. That is no way to strengthen American manufacturing. The New York Federal Reserve estimated in 2019 that the Section 301 China tariffs cost the average household $831 per year, a figure that has likely increased with inflation. The new tariffs have a clear record of failure, as conservative economists almost unanimously warned would be the case. Job number one for the next administration is to return to sensible trade policies and eliminate the destructive Trump-Biden tariffs, strengthening American manufacturing. The decline of American manufacturing is a common political trope in both parties, typically invoked before a call for more government intervention. This narrative has several problems. One is that American manufacturing output is currently at an all-time high. The record was not set during World War II and not during the 1950s boom. Output did not peak when manufacturing employment peaked in 1979 or during the Reagan economic revival in the 1980s. It is actually higher now than it has ever been, American manufacturing is buoyant because each manufacturing worker's productivity is also at an all-time high. The key to prosperity is doing more with less. The next president should ignore special interests and populist ideologues who want government to do the opposite through industrial policy, trade protectionism, and other failed progressive policies. It takes surprisingly few people to achieve America's record high manufacturing output. Currently, about 13 million people out of a workforce of more than 160 million, compared to the 1979 peak of 19.5 million people out of a workforce of 104 million. Productivity growth has freed the time and talents of millions of people for other additional uses. The belief that manufacturing has to shrink for services to grow is the zero-sum fallacy against which sensible economists often warn. It is anathema to the optimism, hope, and confidence that are the natural birthright of conservatives. Growing productivity enables more output of both manufacturing and services. That is why America continues to have sustained booms and record-setting real GDP despite the long-run decline in manufacturing employment. Economists distinguish between two types of growth, extensive and intensive. Extensive growth is the Soviet and Chinese model for manufacturing. If you have more people use more resources, they will create more output. Extensive growth is doing more with more. Intensive growth is doing more with less. That is where America's superpower lies. The story of American manufacturing is one of intensive growth dating back to our agricultural origins. Conservative leaders should draw on this history to position America for continued success. With intensive growth, it is not manufacturing or services. It is manufacturing and services. Retaliatory tariffs. Raising tariffs on another country almost always invites retaliatory tariffs against the U.S. The latter tend to be directed at politically sensitive American exports. Retaliatory tariffs by both China and American allies in response to the 2018 steel tariffs were targeted primarily at American agriculture. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, those tariffs cost farmers $27 billion with losses concentrated particularly in heartland states. Retaliatory tariffs also targeted U.S. industries that were not protected by tariffs. Many imports become inputs into U.S. manufacturing. The motorcycle maker Harley-Davidson was already facing higher production costs as domestic steel producers raised their prices to accommodate the new steel tariff. A retaliatory tariff on its motorcycles imposed by the European Union further raised its prices and hurt its export business. Harm to such innocent bystanders was another unintended, though foreseen, consequence. Federal Reserve research shows that the tariffs have cost about 75,000 manufacturing jobs while creating only about 1,000 jobs in the steel industry, not including the effects of the retaliatory tariffs described above. Higher steel prices added an average of $250 to the price of new cars, and larger trucks, the vehicle of choice in rural America, were hit even more dramatically. Trade is generally a win-win for both participants. Tariffs are a lose-lose-lose game, with the tariff raiser losing affordable goods, the tariff target losing exports, and the tariff raiser losing again from retaliatory tariffs. Tariffs also have an additional overlooked hidden cost. Companies redirect resources to dodge tariffs by redesigning products, switching to more expensive suppliers, using lower quality materials, and lobbying. This might be good for lawyers, but it is bad for the economy. These resources could have been used instead to make a better product more cheaply. Conservatives warned against retaliation from the beginning. it was exactly what happened after the 1930 Smoot-Hawley tariffs that worsened the Great Depression, undoing the normalization of protectionism. Inertia is one of the strongest forces in politics. Radical new policies can become the new normal very quickly and are extremely difficult to unwind if they backfire. This happened with the Trump administration's progressive turn on protectionism. The Biden administration quickly undid the Trump administration's conservative regulatory reforms, but left its progressive, self-defeating trade policies in place, in many cases even strengthening them. Two presidential administrations is a long time in politics, and the next conservative administration will have a tough time getting tariff relief past a bureaucracy that dislikes change and special interests that will fight hard to preserve their special privileges. But given the stakes for future American prosperity, it will be worth it. Dealing with disruption. It is true that trade is disruptive. Though its long-run effect on employment is approximately zero, in the short run, it can cost jobs and even depopulate towns. America's resilience depends on its ability to adjust, but successful and timely adaptation is generally spontaneous in nature, the work of human action, but not human design. Planned adjustment by governments has a much poorer track record. Context is also important to adjustment efforts. Technological change costs approximately 6 times more jobs, as does trade, though, again, only in the short run. Any argument made against trade's disruptive effects applies even more strongly to technological change, yet no one seriously argues for reversing the dramatic changes the internet has wrought. More than 11 million American jobs turn over through hirings, firings, retirements, layoffs, and resignations every month, and nearly 85% of all jobs turn over in the course of a year. Yet America has suffered only 4 bouts of double-digit unemployment during the past century. 2 of them, the Great Depression and the comedown from the 1970s stagflation, were due to monetary mismanagement, not trade. The third, the Great Recession, was due to a financial crisis worsened by monetary mismanagement, not trade. The fourth was due to COVID-19 lockdowns, not trade. Using trade restrictions to slow this churn is a mistake for 2 reasons. 1, trade is at best a minor contributor to job churn compared to other factors like technology, changing consumer tastes, inflation, and business cycles. And 2, churn is evidence of a healthy economy. Agricultural economies have low job churn and low living standards. When people see better opportunities, they should be allowed to pursue them. To do otherwise slows economic growth, harms individual dignity, removes humanity from our policies, and can contribute to societal ills like depression, addiction, and isolation. Trade adjustment could be made easier by regulatory reforms to remove its attendant friction. These include less restrictive zoning and permit rules, occupational licensing reform, automatic sunsets for new regulations, and a presidentially appointed regulatory reduction commission that would examine the code of federal regulations each year and send repeal packages to Congress that include old, obsolete, redundant, and harmful regulations. People who need help should be able to get it. Progressive trade policies help only special interests while harming the very people they are supposedly intended to help. Trade adjustment assistance. Trade adjustment assistance is a popular policy for aiding displaced workers. Though flawed, it is a bargaining tool that can potentially help to get sound trade policy adopted. a conservative administration should approach trade adjustment assistance with caution and use it as a last resort political bargaining tool and not as a first resort policy. Funding for job training programs and the like will typically find its way to labor union slush funds, left-leaning nonprofits, and other progressive causes that will not necessarily help displaced workers. A better approach to trade adjustment assistance, if it must be expanded, is direct cash transfers. Not only would this prevent progressive hijacking of programs and their funding, but cash is the most flexible type of aid. It treats people as adults and lets them make their own choices about their next steps. Major life decisions should be made by individuals for themselves, not for them in Washington. Trade adjustment assistance should treat workers who lose their jobs to international trade the same as workers who lose their jobs for any other reason are treated. While that will not likely come to pass in the near future, steps in that direction are possible. Technological change displaces 6 times as many workers as trade displaces, yet workers displaced by technology get no special treatment, nor should they. Unemployment remains low because it grows alongside population, and real wages continue to rise over time. Trade displaced workers should be eligible for the same benefits for which anyone else is eligible, no more and no less. Supply chain lessons from the baby formula debacle. Protectionism builds weaknesses into supply chains. This was demonstrated vividly by the baby formula shortage, which may have peaked in 2022 but remains an ongoing concern. Domestic baby formula producers benefit from a decades-old tariff that averages 17%, which is effectively high enough to shut imports out of the market. As if tariffs were not enough, other requirements also help to keep competition out of the market. Ever-evolving labeling requirements and nutritional standards that, conveniently for domestic manufacturers, are always just slightly different from international standards. As a result, before the formula shortage in 2022, approximately 98% of the country's baby formula was produced domestically. With foreign competition out of the way, other government policies helped to concentrate almost the entire domestic formula industry into 4 firms. Roughly 40% of baby formula purchases are made by state-level food assistance programs, which typically do not let families choose their own formula brands. Instead, they must buy from a single producer, which guarantees producers large market shares in states where they win contracts. This situation gives incumbent producers a cozy existence, but puts consumers at risk. Like all protectionist policies, the benefits are concentrated in the hands of a few producers, while the costs and risks are widely distributed. With so many eggs in so few baskets, whenever something goes wrong, which is inevitable even when nobody is at fault, families find themselves scrambling. That happened early in 2022 when contamination entered a Michigan facility that makes about 40% of America's baby formula. Trade protectionism all but eliminated other options for many parents, who suddenly found empty shelves and sky-high prices for an essential item that many of them were already struggling to afford, while families in other countries were unaffected. In response, Congress passed the Formula Act in the summer of 2022. The act eased formula tariffs and loosened never-needed labeling requirements and other import restrictions, but it was temporary. It expired at the end of 2022, leaving families still vulnerable to the cascading consequences that ensue if one thing goes wrong at only one plant. The baby formula debacle has two lessons for the next administration. The administration needs to attack the root of the problem. Temporary fix-it bills are better than nothing, but they leave the rot in place. The president needs to encourage bold liberalization. Strength comes from openness. In the real world, markets fail. Factories will get contaminated, and health inspectors will not always be as thorough as they should be. The baby formula market is essentially a natural experiment in self-sufficient industrial policy. When something went wrong, that single failure point crashed the whole system. It should not be that way, and the next president can change it. Part of the problem is that the supply chain analogy itself causes sloppy thinking. In a chain, a link is connected only to the link ahead of it and the link behind it, and not to any other links. Real-world supply chains are more like networks in which each point connects directly to countless others and is rarely more than 6 degrees of separation from nearly anywhere on Earth. Because market failures happen all the time, it is important to have as many connections as possible. Americans need access to more ways to adapt and reroute around failure points, especially for essential products like baby formula. Trade protectionism makes us more vulnerable, but free trade makes our families and communities more resilient. Loosening restrictions similar to the ones that stunt the baby formula market would make it easier to navigate future crises while preventing the progressive and rent-seeking power grabs that come with every crisis, whether it is as isolated as a baby formula shortage or as expansive as a pandemic. Mutual recognition. A simple way to reduce friction in supply networks is mutual recognition of other industrialized countries' regulatory standards. This can be done either in a larger trade agreement or independently. For baby formula, this would mean allowing in brands that meet European Union standards, even if they do not meet Food and Drug Administration, FDA, labeling requirements. Infants' nutritional needs do not change across borders. If a formula is deemed healthy for European babies, then it is also healthy for American babies. The reverse is equally true. Mutual recognition could help to open new markets for American producers in countless industries and give American consumers access to countless new products on more competitive terms. For example, U.S. regulations require washing machine power cords to be at least 6 feet long, while the U.K. requires them to be at least 2 meters. The difference, about 6 inches, affects neither safety nor performance, but it does keep American-made washing machines out of an important foreign market. A mutual recognition policy would circumvent the problem. Given the recent interest in increased antitrust enforcement, conservatives should embrace policies like mutual recognition that have the double benefit of increasing market competition while decreasing government's regulatory footprint. The U.S. should enact mutual recognition agreements for a wide variety of goods with the United Kingdom, European Union, Japan, South Korea, Australia, and other governments with high standards comparable to our own. This would have especially large benefits for pharmaceuticals because America's FDA drug approval process is both slower and more expensive than those of other countries without being any safer. Americans would gain access to more and lower cost medical treatments, and American pharmaceutical companies could defray development costs and innovate faster by gaining access to more markets, all while cutting prices. The Jones Act. The Jones Act, Merchant Marine Act of 1920, requires that ships traveling between U.S. ports must be U.S. built, U.S. owned, and U.S. crewed. In practice, this is an America Last policy that has decimated the American maritime industry. Because of Jones Act regulations, American-built ships cost 3 to 4 times more to build than foreign-built ships cost. As a result, the entire Jones Act fleet is down to just 92 ships, many of which are old and obsolete. In fact, Jones Act compliant shipping is so expensive that it is often cheaper for East Coast ports to import oil from Vladimir Putin's Russia than it is to send it up the coast from Houston or New Orleans. The national security, to say nothing of energy security, implications of reliance on Russia for oil and gas are obvious. The Jones Act's original national security justifications are just as dubious. The Act's goal was to guarantee a sizable fleet of American ships that could be pressed into war service if needed. Aircraft carriers and other post-1920 naval innovations have made this argument obsolete. An $800 billion defense budget has plenty of room to maintain a Navy to defend American security interests around the world. The U.S. Navy would likely prefer not to use Jones Act ships anyway, because they tend to be older and in poorer condition than its own ships or similar foreign-made but domestically owned commercial ships that could also be pressed into service. As with many other industries, U.S. shipbuilding could be the envy of the world if it could operate in a free market, but the maritime lobby prefers a quiet, cozy existence on the dole, even as it harms American consumers and national security. The next conservative administration should unleash American potential by unilaterally enacting Jones Act exemptions wherever allowed, as currently happens most years during hurricane season, and working with Congress to repeal the Jones Act. Trade and inflation. The post-COVID inflation spike may be over long before the next administration takes office, but keeping it under control should remain a high priority. Free traders should not oversell their case by saying that liberalization would solve inflation. Inflation is predominantly a monetary phenomenon, not a trade phenomenon, but tariff relief can help at the margin by immediately lowering prices on tariffed goods and slightly boosting long-term growth. While this would not affect the money supply, which is inflation's key variable, even rolling back the tariffs enacted since 2017 would likely have a positive effect on the consumer price index. The easiest way to curb inflation, or to create it, is for the Federal Reserve to work the monetary side of the equation, but the real output side has a similar effect on prices. Lifting trade barriers is one way to boost output. It also has the added benefit of requiring no additional spending. At the very least, this can make the Federal Reserve's job easier as the spending excesses of Congress and President Biden continue unabated in the coming years. It is important not to oversell trade's inflation benefits as a cure-all, but at the margin, it can help. The next administration should keep this in mind as it tries to cope with this politically volatile issue. Trade and foreign policy. We have seen how trade liberalization would boost the domestic economy and make American businesses more competitive. But conservative trade policies also benefit America's foreign policy interests. Policymakers should therefore negotiate multilateral and bilateral trade agreements, reform the World Trade Organization, or build a successor organization with membership limited to liberal democracies. Repeal the Jones Act to replace Russian energy imports with domestic production. Develop a multifaceted long-term China policy that takes seriously America's biggest foreign policy threat and deals with it on several fronts. National security. the most persuasive arguments against a market-oriented trade policy come from another national objective, national security. Protectionism and similar progressive policies tend to weaken American security, but trade creates peace. The more countries trade, the less likely they are to fight one another, and the more robust their supply networks will be. Going to war with customers is bad for business. Without a strong economic interest in continued U.S. investment and exports, for example, China's behavior would likely become increasingly less predictable and more dangerous. Anyone who thinks Chinese Communist Party, CCP, General Secretary Xi Jinping, and the government in Beijing are bad actors now, which they are, should consider what would happen if the Chinese convinced liberal countries like the United States to decouple from them, leaving them free to pursue whatever policies they wish without the significant counterweight that America can provide. That is one reason for Xi Jinping's emphasis on centralization and self-sufficiency. He does not like international pressure about his government's human rights violations and bad faith trading policies, and decoupling from trading partners like America is one way to avoid that pressure. A less constrained China would be poorer, but much more unstable and dangerous to its neighbors and to America than it would be if it still had to engage regularly with the rest of the world. Trade promotion authority. Trade agreements can take years to negotiate. One way to accelerate the process is for Congress to grant the President Trade Promotion Authority, TPA. It was first granted under the 1974 Trade Act, which contains the sections 201 and 301 tariff delegations. TPA, then called Fast Track, has aided several trade agreements, including NAFTA and the USMCA, which took effect in 2020. TPA has lapsed before during slow periods in trade policy, most recently in July 2021, and remains lapsed today. The President should work with Congress to renew TPA to rationalize negotiations for upcoming trade agreements with the United Kingdom, the European Union, and others. Both supporters and critics have questions regarding TPA's implications for the constitutional separation of powers, and policymakers should take those questions seriously. As things currently stand, Congress has some oversight powers over the President's negotiations under TPA, but they are limited. Congress can increase its oversight by passing new legislation superseding relevant provisions of the 1974 Trade Act. However, that is a double-edged sword. A Congress that largely favors free trade could exercise oversight to keep the President on the straight and narrow in trade negotiations. A progressive Congress would instead insist that the President negotiate for as many trade-unrelated provisions as possible to benefit labor and green constituencies, while pushing progressive policies on the U.S. and its trading partners. On balance, a single voice at the negotiating table that is subject to congressional oversight is the best posture for American workers and consumers. A fractious Congress has yet to demonstrate the capacity to negotiate with other nations, but it can help to hold the administration accountable. Trade agreements with the United Kingdom, European Union, and others. Even with a renewed TPA, trade agreement negotiations will likely take years. The Trump and Biden administrations were not inclined to start the process, so that job may well fall to the next administration. In that sense, the delays may end up being worth it. If there is one lodestar to follow, it is to restrict these agreements to trade issues only. Ever since NAFTA, trade-unrelated provisions have taken on a greater role in trade agreements. These create sticking points and are routinely hijacked by rent-seeking special interests and progressive ideologues who demand subsidies, carve-outs, and economically distorting labor and environmental standards that have nothing to do with trade. If governments are to negotiate these issues, they should do so in separate agreements so they do not torpedo efforts to liberalize and engage with allies. Trade agreements should lighten burdens, not create new ones by attempting to address non-trade issues. Policy leaders in the United States and the United Kingdom, including experts from the Heritage Foundation and the Competitive Enterprise Institute, have prepared a model trade agreement along these lines. Along with TPA renewal, this would greatly reduce negotiating costs. This template is also readily adaptable for agreements with Europe and any other allies that are willing to liberalize their economies and build a stronger alliance with America. The draft US-UK agreement includes an accession chapter to allow others to join on the same terms. Restoring or replacing the WTO dispute resolution process. The World Trade Organization, as we know it, may be mortally wounded. This deprives the U.S. of the WTO's dispute resolution process, under which the U.S. it won 85% of the cases it brought. The WTO's slow death began under the Obama administration, which refused to allow appointees to the WTO's appellate board, which as a consequence is now non-functional. Both the Trump and Biden administrations have continued the Obama administration's approach. That means that every case in the dispute resolution process will sputter to a halt as parties file appeals that cannot be heard. If the WTO is no longer fit for that purpose, it may be better to look in a different direction. More than 20 years ago, a Heritage Foundation senior fellow proposed that America and other free economies should form a global free trade alliance that is open to all countries that adhere to a truly free market system with appropriate safeguards such as property rights, lack of corruption, and enforcement of contracts. Alongside a general agreement on low to zero tariffs, the alliance would move to reduce the effect of non-tariff barriers, such as the previously noted baby formula ingredient and labeling barriers, by basing trade around the principle of mutual recognition. Such an alliance could be started by a trade agreement between the United States and, for example, the United Kingdom, with an accession chapter allowing others to join if they meet the criteria. It would be essential for a global free trade alliance to avoid the WTO's most serious problem, the exemptions from its rules that are granted to developing countries. When China joined the WTO in 2001, it was granted developing Nantian status, which it continues to use to dodge rules that should apply to it. Other countries have used that status to delay needed reforms. Rule exemptions give some countries a perverse incentive to remain poor and autocratic. A global free trade alliance would allow the U.S. to enjoy the benefits of a rules-based international trading system without the WTO's shortcomings. Negotiation costs would be lower because the countries would already be allied on many issues. In addition, there would be no separate tiers with different rules, and this would give developing countries an incentive to liberalize. In addition to being good for its own sake, liberalization would give them entry into a prestigious club that tilted toward America's orbit and away from China's. Closing the Export-Import Bank. The Export-Import Bank, EXIM, is an unusually clear example of how vulnerable trade protectionism is to being hijacked by special interests. In most years, about half of EXIM's business benefits a single company, Boeing. Their relationship is so cozy that EXIM's nickname around Washington is the Bank of Boeing. Unlike most other agencies, Exium has a charter that expires. Congress must renew it periodically, or else the agency will permanently close. Its current charter expires at the end of 2026. Closing this New Deal-era legacy agency would be a conservative victory on a number of fronts. It is also a winnable battle. Congress just needs to do nothing. Conservatives have both foreign policy and economic reasons to oppose Exim. Exim has a long history of providing financing for authoritarian governments in China, Russia, and the Middle East that often oppose U.S. foreign policy interests, and its deals often oppose U.S. economic interests. Exim financing also harms domestic airlines. Many Exim financing deals enable foreign state-run airlines to buy Boeing jets at a discount. These foreign airlines, subsidized by the U.S. government, then compete directly with U.S. airlines on international routes. More recently, the Biden administration has expanded Exim's mission to advance progressive policy goals, including limits on financing for projects that involve fossil fuels or contribute to climate change, preferential treatment for renewable energy projects, and quotas for projects that benefit women-owned and minority-owned businesses. All of these could raise Exim's default rates, putting taxpayer dollars at risk. The strongest argument in Exim's favor is that it boosts U.S. exports by financing projects that would otherwise never receive financing. We now have evidence that this argument is false. Exim does not finance additional exports. Instead, it largely substitutes for other forms of export financing that would occur anyway. Exim's authorization lapsed in 2014-2015 because of conservative opposition to renewing its charter. During this lapse, Exim maintained its existing portfolio, but was unable to take on new business. Boeing reported no trouble finding alternative financing and even reported record profits during Exim's lapse while working to fulfill a 7-year backlog of orders. Exim boasts an extremely low default rate, but that is because of selection bias. Exim overwhelmingly takes on low-risk projects that private banks would be happy to finance. Although this admittedly could change somewhat with Exim's Biden-era mandates to finance climate and other policy-focused projects. Exim is also a textbook example of regulatory capture. It has a long record of deals with authoritarian governments. It subsidizes direct foreign competitors of domestic businesses. It has been hijacked by progressives to advance their climate and other preferred policies. Its beneficiaries have proven they can get adequate financing from private banks. Exim's charter expires at the end of 2026. The agency will close automatically unless Congress and the president decide to extend it. Closing Exim should be one of the next administration's easiest decisions, adopting a multi-pronged China strategy. An effective American policy toward China needs to take a realistic view of the country, its leaders, their strengths, and the serious challenges they face. It should be comprehensive and flexible. A threatened CCP is dangerous. Perhaps now more than at any time since Mao Zedong, as Xi Jinping continues to use strong-arm tactics to consolidate his power and saber-rattling to challenge the international order. At the same time, recent revelations about China's official statistics overstating its GDP by 30% track well with other problems that were already known. These include one of the world's worst demographic aging curves thanks to China's one-child policy, a population that may already be declining, an unsustainable debt load that is already causing problems. Countless failed boondoggles, from empty cities to its underwhelming Belt and Road Initiative that are wasting significant resources. Xi Jinping's authoritarian turn, increasing state control of the economy, and a zero COVID policy that has sabotaged the economy and driven away foreign investment. America has its problems, but it is in better shape than China on nearly every measure, especially in the long run. While the facts on the ground should inoculate the next administration against the most strident, China fear-mongering circulating in the media and in Washington, that does not mean that the government in Beijing is no threat to American interests. The question is, what should we do about it? A serious China policy will require American policymakers to integrate doctrines, institutional prerogatives, expertise, and realistic objectives. Traditional cabinet-level bureaucracies, like those at the Departments of Defense, State, and Commerce, will need to work together to pursue a comprehensive American strategy. Scores of incremental, narrowly targeted policies are necessary. They will not make for good soundbites on cable news, and many will operate slowly and out of sight from most news cycles, even as progress is made. An effective China policy must also allow for adaptation, because the CCP will not sit idly by. As people react to developments, America needs flexible options. Trade isolationism is inherently inflexible because it reduces the number of contact points with China. This is a tougher political sell than loud, simplistic jeremiads, but going the extra mile to solve these difficult coordination problems is vital to America's interests. Trade and engagement with China are necessary if we are to contain the threats that China poses to its neighbors and to the U.S. The next administration should end China's developing nation status in the WTO and other international organizations. China is an advanced manufacturing economy and should be treated as such, even if its political and legal institutions remain those of a developing nation, to prevent it from exploiting its status to gain special privileges. Use a target, not a blanket. There should be actions against Chinese firms that are known to have engaged in unfair trade practices such as intellectual property theft. Rather than blanket tariffs or non-tariff barriers aimed at entire Chinese industry sectors, firms that act in bad faith should be targeted individually. This policy was employed to good effect early in the Trump administration, but was abandoned in favor of a less effective blanket tariff policy. Rejoin the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Dropping out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement might have been the Trump administration's biggest trade policy mistake. The TPP was already negotiated and would have strengthened an alliance against China, including most of its biggest trading partners in East Asia and the Americas. America's departure created tensions and infighting, distracting the U.S. and its allies from the goal at hand: countering China. The other 11 TPP countries continue without American input or influence under the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, CPATPP, to develop a modern institutional framework to contain Chinese commercial imperialism. Rejoining this alliance should be a top priority in the next conservative administration's China policy. Accession negotiations are likely to be difficult, given that the CPATPP suspended several clauses that were important to the United States, such as provisions relating to patents and aspects of investor-state dispute resolution, when the U.S. pulled out of the TPP agreement in 2017. Diplomatic and economic pressure against Beijing will be more effective when its largest trading partners work in concert. Beijing's diplomats will have a hard time employing a divide-and-conquer policy against a united front of the sort that the TPP offers. Refocus the Indo-Pacific economic framework for prosperity on trade. President Biden began the process to create IPEF in 2022, but any agreement will likely still be under negotiation when the next administration takes office. IPEF is similar to the TPP, but its member, 816 countries, are mostly China's neighbors in Asia. Like the TPP, it seeks to create an alliance to push China toward the rule of law, but the Biden administration so far has left trade entirely out of the agreement. Instead, the IPEF negotiations are focusing entirely on non-trade issues like climate and labor policy, issues that give progressives opportunities to impose their policies on other countries and provide rent-seeking opportunities for labor unions and politically connected businesses in renewable energy and other favored industries. IPEF has the potential to be a powerful diplomatic tool that helps to bring countries into America's orbit and away from China's. Beijing's chauvinistic approach to foreign policy has alienated most of China's neighbors and allies. They follow along because they lack alternatives. IPEF and the TPP could offer them a way out and make it easier for China's smaller neighbors to stand up for themselves in a united front as they move toward American-style institutions that protect civil, political, and economic liberties. IPEF could do all that, and so could the TPP. But America currently has no voice in the TPP, and IPEF risks becoming little more than another tool that progressives can use to force their policy wish list on countries that don't want it. From the perspective of IPEF's members, the Biden administration's approach is little different from Beijing's. The next administration can give China's neighbors a better choice by refocusing IPEF on trade, dropping most of its non-trade issues, and turning it into a forum to promote democracy and strengthen alliances while pressuring Beijing to make needed reforms. Play the long game. It took two generations to win the Cold War, and there were many reasons for that success. The fact that the planned economy is inherently inferior to free market capitalism played a role. So did diplomatic, military, and economic pressure from free countries. But culture was just as important, and it did not come from any government. Blue jeans and rock and roll helped to win the Cold War as much as any deliberate policy did. So did images of fashion and prosperity in American movies and television shows like Dallas. Such informal bottom-up processes will also play a vital role in helping to turn China from an authoritarian threat into a freer and less hostile power. It will take a long time, and the slow process will garner few headlines, but it can work. A conservative administration will support efforts by ordinary Americans to engage with ordinary Chinese people through social networks, internet memes, fashion, movies, student exchange programs, tourism, and more. China's leaders are set in their ways, especially with Xi Jinping presumably now in power for life, but the younger generation is more open than their parents were, more individualistic and open to change. Effective outreach to the Chinese people will need the same humility that other sound trade policies require. Government-directed cultural and economic outreach risks being heavy-handed and could backfire. Everyone involved needs to know that the process is generational in scope and will not work overnight. At the very least, Washington should stay out of the way as much as possible when regular people want to contact each other across national, language, and cultural divides. Each of these many components, from tariffs to trade agreements to culture, is a small part of a larger China policy. Many are not attention-grabbing and cannot be put into sound bites. Cultural engagement is not something Washington can plan. China's own demographic and debt problems, along with aging leadership and growing discontent over the zero COVID policy, might even cause an internal collapse. American policy must therefore be prepared to face any contingency. Conclusion. A conservative trade policy needs a conservative vision. America's founding institutions, based on free trade and entrepreneurship, have made America the world's leading economy and will help keep America strong through the next century. However, recent departures from those principles have hurt America's economy and weakened alliances that are necessary to contain threats from Russia and China. Reaffirming those principles through policies of openness, dynamism, and free trade will boost America's economy, make us more resilient against crises, and remove opportunities for progressives and rent seekers to use the levers of government for their own purposes. Rediscovering conservative principles on trade policy and embracing America's long history as the world's leading commercial republic are an important part of restoring a government of, by, and for the people.